So indeed, I'm going to emphasize the detection of supernova neutrinos. And until recently, that's been a fairly dismal science, just because it's been a fairly rare business to detect anything. of course, probably everybody in this room remembers where they were when they heard the news 17 years ago, before and after. So Sander Leek was gone, but not forgotten. There's a canonical shot. Based on the few events that we saw, the few neutrinos that we saw that day, on average, there's been one theory paper written and published every 10 days for 17 years. Okay? So it's pretty clear that these events excite people. So I don't get to tell you guys why these are exciting. We just heard a nice talk about some of the key physics topics. And also, a lot of you guys either ran some of those experiments that detected the neutrinos back then, or wrote some of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of theory papers. At any rate, one fact I just want to point out quickly about 87A was that at 170,000 light years, this is the most distant source of neutrinos ever detected. And in fact, it's the only source further than our own sun. It's a nice, easy to remember factor. It's very close to 10 to the 10 times as far as our sun. So these are the long distance jump champions so far in the neutrino world. All right, so anybody who's given this particular talk to give at this meeting has got to pay homage to the different experiments that are out there. And of course, we've heard about many of these experiments, some at this conference already, many of them at this conference already. So we're just going to sort of sweep by them. Anyway, so these are the ones that are standing ready as we speak to observe the next galactic supernova. So we've got Baksan, which is actually the only fellow that was running back in 87 that's still here, and it still stands ready to observe something. We've got Miniboon, which surprisingly has quite good supernova detection capabilities, even sitting on the surface as it does. We've got LVD, which is also waiting. We have Camland, Amanda, Snow, and Super K. That's what we've got online at this moment. And, you know, in terms of event rates, these range anywhere from on the order of 25 events for a supernova at the galactic center, or 10 kiloparsecs, 25 events in Baksan, to on the order of 10,000 events in Super K. So that's sort of the range. Now, there are a number of experiments on deck that are coming along. Some are proposed, some are under construction, some are quite fantastical, and we don't know what's going to happen to them. But anyway, these include Moon, Oryxeno, Clean, Icarus. This is ultimately known as SNBO, or Adonis, or Omnis. It's actually also very similar to what has been proposed recently to do with some of the extra helium-3 counters from Snow. Ice Cube, Uno, and Hyper-K. Hyper-K indeed is now a double barrel design. But this is the nicest graphic I had of this one. At any rate, so here it ranges, this guy would be the champion. This would see about 300,000 individual events at 10 kiloparsecs. Now, that's the good news. There are a lot of experiments out there. But on the other hand, we've got a sobering anniversary coming up. This October 9th, unless we have any happy surprises between now and then, it will be exactly 400 years since we last saw a supernova in our galaxy. Now, of course, we don't see the whole galaxy. This is long before telescopes and, just before telescopes there. But, it's a kind of a tough game. So, what are you going to do? If you really love supernova neutrinos, and I think we all do, what are you going to do? Well, the galactic supernovas are somewhat rare, let's say between every 25 years and every 50 or 60 years in our galaxy. So that's kind of rare on a human time scale. But supernovas, of course, are not rare things at all. And there's one explosion somewhere in our universe every second that makes neutrinos. So these make up the diffuse supernova neutrino background, which I'm going to call DSNB. This is often known as the relic supernova neutrino background. I'm trying to get away from the word relic here because we also use relic to talk about the Big Bang relics, and there's sometimes confusion about that. They're very different. Anyway, so these are really the champions. These relic neutrinos, these DSNB events, travel an average of 6 billion light years, which is the longest long baseline you're ever going to get. And there's lots of them. You get about 100,000 through your body, real supernova neutrinos, every single second. So they're there. The theoretical predictions have been somewhat varied, especially down at the lower end, based on where they think, where in the redshift C they think things are happening. But out in here, the other than a normalization factor, things are fairly well behaved. All of these models, I should note, we'll get back to these later. So these are various models. As of 2002, that's what was available in terms of predictions. So last year, SuperK published the world's best limits on this flux. There's the site. And so there are those theory curves. And here is the data in SuperK after different reduction steps. And you can see here that there's a wall, so of course a log scale, there's a wall of background that comes up here. And those are spallation events, primarily, from the cosmic rays that excite stuff in the water in SuperK. So we had to make a cut here at about 19 MeV and just go above that. And that's sort of painful because you know the spectrum is rising like crazy over here. Anyway, so you can see that we kind of constrained a couple of the models. This model, the dark blue one, was not a realistic model. That was assuming a constant supernova rate for the whole universe history. But at any rate, we did sort of bite into this one a bit. And so this is sort of, this is what the data actually looked like for the entire data sample that was used. This is SK1 data, almost 1,500 days of data. This hump here is from Michel electrons, from muons, which get into the detector below threshold. They don't make any muon Cherenkov light. The muon decays, and you get a nice electron-like ring, and you go, oh, that could be a positron from inverse beta decay. And then this is the tail of the atmospheric neutrino spectrum. So these are fairly difficult to eliminate, these backgrounds, if you've got singles. Still, this result was quite a powerful one. We improved the limit in this range that we could access by about two orders of magnitude over the best limit previously. And this is quite significant because now you see, here's our limit. And now we're within a factor of two or three of all the remaining candidates. This candidate, by the way, was simply an upper bound. It was not published as a best value. So we chopped that one. This was the non-realistic one. So now we're within a factor of two or three, not a factor of 200 or 300. So all of a sudden, the game changed. So we're getting close. And if we could push just a little bit more, if we could go a little lower in energy, if we could remove a little more of the background, this would be really valuable. But how to do it? Well, again, these are all singles. There's some light in the detector. And that's it. Something that people don't really appreciate is that SuperK is a very quiet detector. It's not as deep as some, but it's actually still quite quiet. And our singles rate in these energies, in fact, for our entire low-E sample, much lower in energy than this, where we've got backgrounds, is just 3 events per cubic meter per year. That's it. It's really quite quiet. Of course, if you're looking for something that only happens 3 or 4 times a year, and you've got a lot of cubic meters in SuperK, that can be a problem. Okay, so with this in mind, John Beekman and I decided, all right, can we nail this thing? Can we figure out a way to get a positive DSNB signal within 4 years from now? That was our rather ambitious goal. And as it's turned out, this theory and experiment working together has been very productive and has worked quite well. Let you guys be the judge of that. So, the idea was, wouldn't it be great, we thought, if we could tag every one of these rare relic events in SuperK? Uniquely know that's what it was. Well, the reaction we're looking for is the usual inverse beta. And this is what we see currently. We just see the positrons. So if there's some other kind of background, something else that makes light, and it's electron-like, you can be confused. So if we could have some way to identify the neutron in Super K and look for coincident signals, if you've only got 3 events per cubic meter per year, if you get a coincident signal in a few microseconds, you're golden. But we have to compete with the hydrogen in capturing the neutrons. We can't just dump plain old salt into Super K. I mean, people may say, well, snow put salt in, but snow doesn't have hydrogen, they have deuterium. And hydrogen, unfortunately, is a fairly aggressive neutron absorber, and it emits light that's below the Super K threshold when it does so. So those neutrons are lost, the ones that are absorbed by hydrogen. So in order to compete with the hydrogen, we would have to add 3 kilotons of salt to the 50 kilotons of water in Super K just to get half of the neutrons to go on chlorine and half on the hydrogen. So for something rare, that's just not going to do it. So eventually we turn to the best neutron capturer known, as people have done in the past in other applications, gadolinium. The trick was getting it into Super K in a way that would work. So we found a compound, gadolinium trichloride, the salt of gadolinium, which, unlike metallic gadolinium, is highly water-soluble. Metallic gadolinium doesn't dissolve in water at all. And as you probably know, it's a terrible fight to get it to dissolve in scintillator. It's a very dubious chemistry. In water, this stuff, you just dump it in, it goes. You can dissolve twice as much of this by mass in water as you can regular salt. So the neutron capture here gives you a nice 8 MeV gamma cascade. No problem in Super K to see that. If we had 100 tons of this stuff in Super K, 0.2% by mass of GDCl3 and 0.1% gadolinium, this would yield more than 90% of the neutron captures on gadolinium and the remainder on hydrogen. 0.2% would go to the chlorine. So actually the chlorine helps us a little bit, but not much. It's not even toxic, which is kind of nice. Don't believe the guy down here, however. It's actually not a tasty lanthanide. The stuff tastes absolutely terrible. It's disgusting. But you could, in fact, drink 12 liters of this stuff directly out of the Super K tank every single day at this concentration and have no ill effects even on autopsy. And this is important when you're talking about mixing in strange chemicals into the environment or into a place where you might have a leak. Who knows? You know, people worry about such things. We know it's not toxic, because this is the chemical that's injected into you if you ever get an MRI scan done. It's a contrasting agent. And so we've got wonderful human toxicology data. But wait a minute now. Maybe you thought I was swinging one by you. Didn't I say 100 tons of this rare earth thing? What's that going to cost? Okay, well, let's check. Now, indeed, 20 years ago, if I had proposed this, that much gadolinium would have cost $400 million. So no go. Super K costs about $100 million. However, 9 years later, it had dropped an order of magnitude. 6 years after that, another factor of 4. And today, three orders of magnitude drop in 20 years. And you might say, well, how in the heck did that happen? Well, a giant production facility was opened in the Gobi Desert in China. And they have been just making the stuff. They scaled up 1950s technology to the extent that it could be scaled. And there is tremendous amounts being produced now. And you know, when you make one rare earth, you make all of them. So if you have one rare earth that doesn't have a very big market, you tend to get a big mountain of it sitting in your parking lot somewhere. So we've got kind of an interesting situation here. Okay, so, well, maybe we can afford to do it. Maybe Super K can be turned into a great big antineutrino detector and just slowly, steadily collect this handful of these VSNV events every year. That would be very nice. And then, of course, you can imagine a next generation detector like a Hyper-K and UNO collecting 100 plus of these a year. Wouldn't that be something? So I want to emphasize at this point, that this is the only detection technique for neutrons which is extensible beyond the tens of kiloton scale. You can't do that with heavy water or scintillator or helium-3 counters. If you want to do a megaton, this is what you're going to have to do. And in fact, even for a hyper-K, this is going to add about 1% to the total cost. Okay, well, if we can do relics, we can do a great job with a galactic supernova. So in water triangle, as you heard in the previous nice talk, mostly you get inverse betas. These will now each have a tag. And they'll have a distinct tag in time and space. We can subtract them away individually, not statistically. Study their spectrum, their energy, you know, their behaviors, any little wiggles in the time, whatever. We can subtract those away from the directional elastic scatter events, thanks, which will double our pointing accuracy, as was pointed out in the recent paper. The neutral current oxygen 16 events in water now no longer sit on a big background, and they can be individually identified. These are the monoenergetic gamma lines. And this is also true for the backwards peaked, weakly backwards peaked, charge current O16 events. So we can really deconvolve the supernova. Very nice. So the billions were spilled a little earlier, but here's our proposed name, John and I's proposed name for this project. Yes, it's Gadzooks, which means wow, or oh my gosh. And yes, it's gadolinium antineutrino detectors zealously outperforming old Kamiokande. Super. People love it or they hate it. They don't forget it. Oh, and as long as we're collecting new E-bars, I would say this was one of the more impressive things that we saw at this conference. This is the beautiful Camelin results from their first 22 months of data. Well, Camelin and Super-K are in the same place. Gadzooks will collect this much data in 2 weeks. Granted, the energy resolution isn't quite as good, but the statistics are quite powerful, and we'll see later what this can allow you to do. We can't get quite as low in energy as they can. This shaded region shows our coverage up to however high they go. But this is interesting, I feel. Furthermore, you can imagine a hyper-K with this stuff in it could collect 6 Camelin years of data each day indefinitely. So here is what the coincident signals in super-K with gadolinium will look like. So here's the monstrous reactor signal. There is the band of the supernovas, relic neutrinos. The upper line is from the current SK limit, and the lower line is the absolute lowest possible thing. Actually, more recent calculations, which I'll mention later, show that we're probably almost on top of this upper line is the right number. And then these are the remaining backgrounds from the atmospheric neutrinos. So we actually get a nice little window here for the DSNB events. And the reactors, which limit us on the downward side, are their own signal. So we've been flailing on this for quite a while. It took 1,000 emails back and forth, believe it or not. But anyway, John and I finally got this thing submitted last year, written up and submitted. There's the preprint number. It's been with physical review letters. The referee comments we got back were helpful and supportive, very nice. And we literally expect to hear them say, okay, it's being published any day now. So, in the meantime, we've been really pleased by some of the reaction in the community, and some of you here today. There have been a number of papers that have been inspired in some way and then cite our preprint. So here's a brief selection by topic. So I'm going to cover a few of these in detail, but you can see we've got different people doing different things. It's very nice. For instance, the Strigari et al. Paper, they are the ones who had that relic limit that was cut in half, the upper bound. So they went, oh, wait a minute, we're really close to having a detection here, we better redo our calculation. Okay. And so they redid it, they used the latest Sloan Digital Sky Survey data, solar oscillations, they made it a modern analysis, and they find that the present SK limit is just above their best fit prediction. So that's interesting. This Polish group, and this was mentioned the other day in an earlier talk, but this Polish group note that very late stage silicon burning in very large, very close stars could give you about a 2-day early warning that a supernova was about to occur, that the main burst was going to get here. So in Super K, this would mean an increase in the low energy singles rates. This would not be coincident events, just a few neutrons trickling in. But in fact, for Betelgeuse, it would be a factor of 10 increase and could not be missed. So you cancel any calibration work or whatever that was coming up. Then this is from Chobe and Petkov, both of whom are here, as far as I know today. And they went through, they looked at the reactor antineutrino signal in a gadiated Super K. So here right now, this is constraining, this is the usual game of constraining the solar mixing parameters with reactor data. So right now, the error, the 99% spread on delta M squared 2-1 is about 10%. It's a little more than that with the latest Kamlin stuff. A few days ago, it was 31%. Now it's 10%. But anyway, that's the number to look at. And you can see they've got all sorts of scenarios here. But 3 years of SK with gadolinium alone makes that number 1.4%, 99%. And a couple more years, again, with this experiment running by itself, you're sub 1% error. So you are now in a precision measurement error of neutrino mixing parameters. Now, of course, John and I didn't want to just propose a technique and walk away. That's certainly worthwhile, but we really wanted to make this thing work. But, you know, it's not the easiest route to say, let's fiddle with the world's biggest, you know, neutrino detector. So if we're going to go off down the black diamond slope here, we've got to be a little bit wary. You know, you don't want to have something bad happen. And so, you know, we have a number of R&D topics that we've got to investigate. You know, what does this stuff do to the materials that Super K is built out of? Will the water transparency be acceptable? Is there some strange gadolinium chemistry we need to know about? And how will we filter the Super K water to keep it clean but keep the gadolinium in it? And while that's all going on, we want to keep pushing on the physics potential on the higher energy side of things for gadzooks. Okay, well, I personally made a couple of very quick discoveries about gadolinium when I tried to carry a kilogram of it to Tokyo recently from Los Angeles. Okay, first of all, it turns out that the white fluffy gadolinium powder is very opaque to X-rays. Secondly, it turns out that they really get upset when they find a kilogram of white powder in your luggage. But I'm once again free and amongst the living, so I can go on. So while we were preparing that paper, I managed to get some money from the US Department of Energy Advanced Detector Research Program grant specifically to study these R&D issues in gadolinium. So immediately at UC Irvine, we started building a small version of the Super K water filtration system to try to see how we could get the gadolinium out and then put it back in without screwing things up otherwise. While off at LSU, a materials aging study was being put together under Bob Svoboda's supervision. So this March, over in Japan, actually in the Super K dome and tunnel, with the help of some folks from the University of Hawaii, including John Learned, we made some very early, very preliminary measurements of the absolute lower bound of the attenuation length of this stuff. Now, this was not very clean. It was done kind of in a less than ideal way. But we know this is an absolute lower bound, and we know it will get higher once we can remove various dust and bubbles out of our mixture. Anyway, back at Irvine, I now have a water filtering technology which uses reverse osmosis and a new thing called electrodeionization. This can extract 99.9% and even more of the gadolinium in a single pass from the water and then redirect it back into the holding tank, which would be Super K. So these numbers are already almost good enough to go, and they'll probably get better in the future. So we expect that at some point, maybe SK3, the water system will look something like this. We have 0.1% gadolinium in the tank. We have some pretreatment where all the components pass the gadolinium, but maybe not uranium and thorium, and you do some other treatment. Then you have your little gadolinium trap door here, which is what I've developed at Irvine. So now we have the water, the remaining water with no gadolinium in it, which goes through all the other filters that would trap the gadolinium. Okay, so what's next? Yeah, just 1 minute. So I'm going to refine and I'm going to fine-tune the system at Irvine. That's going to continue. Bob Sabota will continue the gadolinium aging studies at LSU. Michael Smee, I didn't mention this in the rest of the talk, but one of my colleagues at Irvine, Michael Smee, will further develop his Monte Carlo, which has gadolinium in it, and will consider new attenuation measurements at UCI and University of Hawaii. So this will cover the next year or so. And after that, well, about a year from now, there's going to be some excellent surplus hardware available. That's when the beam goes off forever in K to K. And in the near detector of K to K, we have a 1 kiloton water Cherenkov detector, basically a 2% scale model of Super K. It's got 700 PMTs in it, you know, all kinds of good stuff. So anyway, I have received at least provisionary approval to go ahead and take this thing over. We haven't signed all the forms, but it's looking very promising right now. So hopefully, a year from now, this will be available for these real studies. We can do the water filtering. In fact, UCI built the water system for this thing. Light attenuation using the real 20-inch PMTs, which fill this. Look at the materials effects. Most of the materials are the same as in Super K. And this would really be a great way to prepare for modifying Super K. That's what the inside of the 1 kiloton looks like. So, in conclusion, a very brief timeline. At Neutrino 2002, sitting in a Munich subway station, John and I first seriously started to discuss how in the world we could see the DSNB events. We knew we had to do neutron tagging, but we didn't know how to do it. So today, Neutrino 2004, the Gadzooks preprint is out. It's getting good press, good response. The R&D is funded and well underway. So, perhaps in Santa Fe, Neutrino 2006, certainly the large-scale R&D, the 1 kiloton tank from K to K, results will be in. We'll know if there's any real damage, any real problem. Maybe, although I think this is a little bit too quick, but SK3 will be running by then. It'll be rebuilt, just a few months old, after all the tubes have been installed, to bring it up to the original configuration. Maybe, if we put in gadolinium, we'll see the first reactor anti-neutrino data there. And then finally, by Neutrino 2008, I predict here today that we will have the first ever DSNB signal reported, plus perhaps 80 Camland years of data from the reactor anti-neutrinos. So I'm going to wrap it up with that, and I think it's going to be an interesting...
Let's thank the speaker. Now, we have very few time for two questions.
So, yeah. Have you looked at the rate of background from U-minus capture on oxygen, chlorine, and gadolinium, which some of the time will mimic the...
Yeah, we've extensively studied all the backgrounds. We prepared this preprint. We went through all kinds of stuff. And in fact, you know, we do have some working real-life examples like Camland that are sensitive to nasty stuff. Now, gadolinium, we don't have... Well, we've studied... We have extensively gone through the backgrounds. That's how I would answer that. Yes.
Yes. Second question. Last one.
Yeah. How much lower is the background from ordinary stars at this energy range that you can detect? I mean, the main
as far as we know,
of course, you cannot detect.
As far as we know, ordinary stars don't make Nui bars in any significant number.
Okay. Let's thank the speaker again.